Our speaker tonight is no stranger to South Georgia and to many of you people here. He comes highly recommended. He is a former speaker at Southeastern and at the International. And from what I have talked with him, he is excellent in his knowledge of AA. With that, I present to you from Riverside, Illinois, Paul.
Thank you, Ray. Good evening, everybody. My name is Paul Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. Hello. Bill, I don't know where you got to, but since you were so helpful to me, I'd like to do something nice for you. Back when Bill was drinking, he went to Las Vegas, and he was sitting there at the bar, and he started talking to this blonde, and she said, "How would you like to buy me a drink?" He said, "Well, I'm no J. Paul Getty, but I'll buy you a drink." A little while later, she said, "Would you like to dance?" And he said, "Well, I'm no John Travolta, but I'll dance with you." A little more time passed, and she said, "How'd you like to go home with me?" And Bill said, "Well, I'm no Don Juan, but I'll go home with you." Several hours later, as he was getting ready to leave, she said, "How about some money?" And Bill said, "Well, I ain't no gigolo, but I'll take it." Glad I had a chance to spend some time with Jerry and Billy from Dallas. Jerry was your speaker last night. Jerry's a lawyer, and what he neglected to mention was that while he was drinking, he and his wife were on a Caribbean cruise, and in the cocktail hour, Jerry overtrained one afternoon and fell overboard into this school of particularly vicious sharks. And before they got the ship turned around, it had gone a couple of miles, but someone had thrown a life preserver to him. And they finally got the ship turned around, and they put a small boat over, and the sailors rowed over to Jerry, thinking that he'd probably be chewed up by the sharks. And there was one shark holding him up, and another had towed the life preserver over to him. Another shark had gotten the fish and was trying to feed him, and a fourth shark was swimming around protecting him. And they hauled him into the boat and took him back to the cruise ship and got him up on the deck, and the captain said, "This is incredible. Those are the most vicious sharks in all the world. And rather than eating you, they saved your life. I don't understand it." He said, "What kind of business are you in?" Jerry said, "I'm a lawyer." And the captain said, "That explains it. It was professional courtesy." Jerry Phelan had said I had to mention his name, or he'd hide my hair grower. Back when Jerry was, or rather, Joe was drinking, why, Joe said that he thought he would try a little psychotherapy, so he went to a psychiatrist, and on his first visit, he said, "Wonder if you can do me any good?" The psychiatrist said, "Well, I've never seen you before. I don't know anything about you. Tell me about yourself. Start at the beginning." Joe said, "In the beginning, I created the heavens and the earth." Probably heard about the time Virgil Warren went someplace to give a talk and nobody showed up except one man and the MC. So 8:30 arrived and Virgil said to the man, "You know, I don't really know if I should talk to just a one-man audience." Man said, "Well, I'm a farmer. I've never been anywhere and there's a lot I don't understand. But if I went out to the field to feed my stock and only one cow showed up, I wouldn't send her away hungry." So Virgil got up and he talked for 3 hours and 27 minutes. And they ended the meeting, and he went down to the one-man audience. He said, "Well, what'd you think of the talk?" The man said, "Well, I'm a farmer. I've never been anywhere." He said, "There's an awful lot of things I don't understand. But if I went out to the field to feed my stock and only one cow showed up, I wouldn't dump the whole damn load on top of her." Probably heard about the Al-Anon lady who was fighting with her husband at Christmas time, so for Christmas she gave him a cemetery lot. The next year passed, and Christmas came and went, and she didn't give him anything. He said, "How come you didn't give me anything for Christmas?" She said, "You didn't use last year's present yet." As Ray mentioned, I live in Riverside, Illinois. If you don't know where that is, it's 973 miles north of Hayhiram. It's a quiet suburb, and it's not the end of the world, but you can see it from there. So dull that if you took LSD, you'd have had visions of Lawrence Welk. But it's a kind of restful, relaxing little place, and not much happens. And the reason it's so quiet is we have some semi-retired Chicago hoodlums who live there, and they don't believe in crime in the streets. Although a few years ago, one of them fell dead while being strangled. I've talked in Georgia a number of times, as Ray mentioned, and I'm not going to say I'm at a loss for words. Who ever heard of an alcoholic who was at a loss for words? The truth may be, but not words. I feel kind of like Elizabeth Taylor's next husband. I know it's expected of me, but I can't figure out how to make it interesting. I came into AA when I was 25 years old, and for those who think it was 3 or 4 years ago, last August I was sober 35 years, and I mention that only because I'm bragging. But last May I was 60 years old, which was quite a surprise. I'm getting to be too old to take yes for an answer. I'm starting to feel like the guy who said he never could remember names till he took that Dale Carmichael course. Incidentally, I not only don't remember Gabriel Heater, I can't even remember radios. Alcoholism is a disease, and AA showed me not just what to do about drinking, but how to live, something I never learned anywhere else. Willpower never kept me sober, and willpower would not keep me sober today. Willpower perhaps can be used to make me work the 12 steps. Probably heard about the lady who was berating her husband because he had no willpower, and she said, "You're disgusting." Goldberg has willpower. She said, "Goldberg smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day for 25 years. 5 years ago, he said, I quit, and he hasn't smoked since. That's willpower." She said, "You don't have any willpower." She said, "Ginsburg has willpower. Ginsburg was drunk every day of his life for 30 years. 6 years ago, he said, I quit. He hasn't had a drink since. That's willpower. You don't have any willpower." Well, her husband was incensed. He said, "I'll show you what willpower is." He said, "I'm going to move into the guest bedroom and stay there forever." 6 months later, he was awakened at 3 o'clock one morning by the wife shaking his bed, and he opened his eyes. He said, "What do you want?" She said, "Goldberg is smoking." I believe that sobriety means that I don't drink and I don't use drugs. I run into some AAs who smoke so much marijuana they get regular Christmas cards from Columbia, and I don't think that's sobriety. I think that AA means that I live without any chemical support of any kind. The only things I know about living, I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've learned them from you. I've had a continuing problem in AA of trying to be smarter than I actually am. This hair didn't fall out, it was beaten out. And I came into AA with what I've come to look on as 2 major handicaps. I come from a long line of Lutheran ministers. In spite of that fact, I believe in God today. But I got too much religious education, and I got too much secular education. I got educated way beyond my intelligence, and it didn't take a lot of education to do that. And over, I have been confused by the simplicity of the AA program. AA gives me everything that I need. I spent a number of years after I sobered up as a retarded mystic. I was reading all those books on advanced spirituality because I knew that some of us in AA were destined for greater spiritual progress than others, and obviously I was one of those. And I read all of these things that will help you to leap into the spiritual stratosphere, and I learned about Zen Buddhism and the yoga aphorisms of Patanjali and all of these things. As time passed, I realized that what had happened was I had strained myself spiritually and gotten a metaphysical hernia. And I began to take some new looks at the big book. And I began to take some looks at that last paragraph that says, I get everything I need in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I need, I get, and invariably when I get what I need, it was just what I wanted all the time. And I found this over and over, and I found this true in the lives of many other alcoholics I have come to know, that everything you and I need is here. When Dr. Vincent Dole, a non-alcoholic trustee, retired a few years ago, in his retiring remarks, he said, my concern for the future of AA is that its principles of personal service may be eroded by money and professionalism. And that's an increasingly valid concern as each day passes. The AA message is a message from one amateur to another amateur. AA did not begin as one of many movements that help alcoholics quit drinking. It started because there was nothing that worked for alcoholics, and today there is nothing that works for alcoholics but Alcoholics Anonymous. The steps are the program, and here I have the answers that I need at any stage of sobriety. I think that therapy is magnificent. Transactional analysis, primal scream, EST, psychodrama, encounter groups, sensitivity groups, growth groups, I think they're all magnificent unless you really need help. And if you really need help and you're an AA, this is where it is. There's a pudgy poet around Chicago who says that being thin is where it's been, but being fat is where it's at. Well, where it's at for me in AA is in working and reworking every one of these 12 steps. You know, we talk about change in AA. I heard about one man who got to be 75 years old and he never had any fun. His wife left him and his kids moved out and he decided to change his life. And he got his face lifted and got a new toupee and some $900 suits. A new Mercedes, and the first day he put the whole thing together, he put on his toupee, a new suit, got in the Mercedes, and he drove 3 blocks. And he got killed in an automobile wreck. And he went to heaven, he says, Lord, why did you let it happen? I never had any fun. The first day I'm going to enjoy life, I get killed. Why? The Lord said, to tell you the truth, Charlie, I didn't recognize you. One time some years ago, I was painting the back fence one afternoon, and there were some little kids about 6 or 7 years old standing around. And they were dressed in cowboy boots and cowboy hats and carrying six shooters. And we talked, and they told me that one of them said, you're Texas Rangers. So whenever I had something to say, I would address the kid as Ranger. And we talked for a while, and finally one of these kids, in a burst of honesty, said, you know, we're not really Texas Rangers, we're kids. And of course, that sums up my life at the time I came to AA. I didn't know who I was, but I had to invent somebody. AA, if I will work the 12 steps, will tell me who I am, where I'm going, and how to get there. Step by step by step, one step after the other, over and over and over. Working the 12 steps treats my alcoholism. Going to meetings and not drinking do not treat my alcoholism. If all I do is go to meetings and not drink, eventually I suffer from untreated alcoholism that comes out as depression, anxiety, fear, hostility, boredom, apathy, all of these symptoms that affect AAs quite frequently after they quit drinking but do not treat their alcoholism with the 12 steps. The answer over and over is not to find a therapist or a tranquilizer. The answer is to use the solutions which have been here all the time. It is sometimes said with fair accuracy, if you want to hide something from an AA member, the best place to put it is in the big book. Because here are the answers that you and I need wherever we are in our sobriety. In order to help myself work the 12 steps, I belong to a step group. We meet on a Tuesday night and we take a step starting from 1, we go up to 12 in 12 weeks. If a new person comes and it's his first meeting and we're on step 6, we don't go back to 1. We continue through. Everybody in that group has a commitment to work and rework every one of these 12 steps. Not talk about them, not theorize about them, not philosophize about them. You'll be amazed at how quickly a meeting moves along if people actually talk about what they're really doing with the step at that particular time. But what that has done for me is it has intensified my understanding of the need to do these things, and it has helped me continue to work and rework the steps. And what I've seen it do for other AAs is that those who were unable to stay sober when they worked the steps begin to stay sober. Those who were sober and suffering the symptoms of untreated alcoholism begin to lose those symptoms of untreated alcoholism. We have a phenomenon in AA which perhaps has not gotten as much attention as it should have. And that is AAs with substantial amounts of sobriety who kill themselves. AAs who have not had a drink or a pill for years, who suddenly, or rather over a period of time, feel so badly that they cannot stand to continue living. A doctor in AA from the Middle West, sober 17 years, killed himself 2 years ago. An AA from the Middle West, also sober 17 years, an iron worker, killed himself 2 years ago. A woman sober 4 years shot herself in the head a year ago, and this has happened again and again. Why? Because untreated alcoholism can be fatal. The answer again and again that I have found is simply to use the solutions which are here all of the time. You probably heard about the Indian who was drunk all over the reservation for 10 years and they finally ran him off. 6 years later, the same Indian came back to the reservation riding a beautiful horse, wearing a custom-tailored buckskin suit, a Rolex on his wrist, and Gucci moccasins on his feet. And the chief of the reservation was standing there as the Indian rode up to the gate on his horse, and the chief raised his hand. He said, "How?" The Indian said, "Chapter 5. I ended up writing for a living. I did a lot of things for a living. When I was drinking, a lot of people said I was a smart fellow and if I would quit drinking, I'd go far. And when I was sober about 4 years, I found myself working as a laborer on a rigging crew in northern Greenland, about 850 miles from the North Pole, which was a lot farther than I had planned to go. But I worked in Greenland on four contracts up in Thule. I worked in Iceland for a year. I worked on the Dew Line in Point Barrow in 56 and 57. A lot of the time my AA came out of the big book. We had an AA up in Point Barrow whose name was Nick. His father was Jewish and his mother was Eskimo. And Nick always swore that to his knowledge he was AA's only Jewskimo, and I think that was probably true. But I ended up writing for a living. Several years ago I was in South America. I visited the Galapagos Islands off the coast of Ecuador, where Darwin got the idea for the theory of evolution from the giant tortoises and the finches. And the giant tortoises get to be 400 and 500 pounds, and I learned that during mating season, the male tortoises get so excited they try to mate with large rocks. It's pretty much like your average AA picnic. A couple of years ago, I was doing an article on the high-profit alcoholism treatment industry. And I was talking with Dr. Robert DeVito, who at that time was head of the Department of Mental Health in the state of Illinois, Developmental Disabilities. And DeVito is a psychiatrist who has treated 1,300 alcoholics in private practice. And I said, "Do you think it's possible to harm an alcoholic by too much treatment?" And Dr. DeVito smiled. He says, "No, I don't think it's possible to harm him," because he said, "We don't know enough to harm him or help him." Then I said, "What do you think of confrontation, this popular concept of raising the alcoholic's bottom and making him quit sooner?" DeVito said, "I have seen it tried many times, and I've never seen it work." "Again and again, what I have seen work for alcoholics," said DeVito, "is pain. And the pain comes from self-will and self-centeredness and irresponsibility. And when any alcoholic has had enough pain, he hits the bottom that Harry Thiebaud used to talk about, where he hears the harsh voice of reality." I've got an old friend, Dr. Hobart Maurer at the University of Illinois, research professor of psychology who retired a while back. And several years ago, Maurer was a great admirer of AA. I asked him what he thought of psychotherapy for the sober alcoholic in AA. And Dr. Maurer said, "If the alcoholic will work the 12 steps and develop the fellowship within the program, this will be far more effective than any psychotherapy I know anything about." It's always useful for me to remember that AA is where the clergymen come to find God's help to stay sober, and AA is where the psychiatrists and psychologists come to find the kind of group therapy that will bring sobriety and order to their lives. The quality of my life is not what it should be. The best place I can go for counseling or therapy is to the Big Book or to an AA member who has done enough continuing work with these 12 steps to understand that how it works means that this is how it works. Dr. Maurer had 2 grants from the Eli Lilly Foundation in the middle 60s, 1965, 66, and 67. And I was one of his board members on administering these grants. And he had a number of psychologists and psychiatrists and clergymen, and I had an opportunity to talk to a number of psychiatrists and psychologists about their views on the benefits of therapy for alcoholics or anybody else, and their views were very interesting. Because over and over and over, they said that wherever therapy had been measured and evaluated, it generally turned out to be less effective than no treatment whatsoever. Dr. William Glasser, who wrote Reality Therapy, noted that if every therapist disappeared from view today, it wouldn't hurt anybody because people would find somebody to talk to tomorrow. And the other thing he said was even more significant. He said, let's face it, when you pay a therapist, you're buying a friend. Perhaps the first thing I learned from you in AA is that we don't sell friendship and we don't sell help. We do this as part of our own recovery, and if we don't do it, perhaps we don't recover. When I was sober just about 8 or 9 months, I heard Paul Stanley talk in Chicago. And over and over, this was in the spring of 1948, over and over Stanley said in his talk, AA is of itself sufficient. And he said this over and over and over. And I didn't believe him at the time, I believe it today. In the 12 and 12 on page 15, it says AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And that is my experience after 35 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, after 35 years of looking in every possible direction for answers that would take me farther than the 12 steps can. Everything I need is here. But it only works to the degree that I do the work in reworking every one of these 12 steps. I don't expect to live on the food I ate 20 years ago or the water I drank 10 years ago. And I don't expect to live on the work I did on these 12 steps 5 or 10 or 30 years ago. I grew up in an AA area in Oak Park, Illinois, that said you work the first 9 steps once and then you get by on 10, 11, and 12 the rest of your life. And I didn't know any better for the first 16 years I was sober. I took an inventory when I was sober a year, and maybe shortly after that, a fifth step, I made amends. When I was sober 16 years, I ran into the view that there would be benefit in redoing every one of these 12 steps. Doing new inventories, new fifth steps, taking step 3 aloud, like it says on page 63 in the Big Book. I've always figured you can't understand something if you haven't tried it. So I began to do these things, and I began to see that they made a change in me beyond what would happen in simply trying to work with 10, 11, and 12. In our group, we believe that if somebody comes to me, for example, to take a fifth step with me, I take a complete fifth step with him at the same time. And when we get done, we're even. I spent a lot of years in AA looking for a guru, and a lot more years trying to convince people I had already become a guru. And I'll tell you, when you sit honestly and tell somebody the whole truth about yourself, you don't sound like a guru. In our group also, we believe that men should take fifth steps with men and women should take fifth steps with women. We find that working on that basis, there is less tendency to generate new material that requires additional fourth and fifth steps. You know, you sometimes hear it said that alcoholics are smarter than other people. I don't know where that came from. It was certainly never started by anybody in Al-Anon. But after I came back from working out of the country in 1959, I came back to the Chicago area, and some things had happened while I was gone that had not been going on when I left in 51. They were having banquets, and they were having conferences, and they were having delegates to New York, and people ran around the country, and they talked at these things. And I entered my leadership phase. I saw that there was a clique that ran these things, so I got my own clique, and I began running around talking, and I began to run conferences and banquets. I became a legend in my own mind. And as time passed, I ran into some misguided people who did not understand God's will when I explained it to them. And I ended up with a lot of very bad relationships with people, which I had created stone sober. You know, we hear a lot about alcoholism as a disease, and that is a useful concept. However, my lying, my selfishness, my greed, my anger, my irresponsibility, my dishonesty, these have nothing to do with the disease of drinking. These have something to do with me unless I work and rework all of the 12 steps. So I gradually ended up with, as I say, a lot of bad relationships with people. I was very, very busy. I was the most hyperactive alcoholic you have ever seen. And when somebody would compliment me on what I was doing, I would mumble something very humbly about how all this was all I could do because I had gotten so much from AA. My definition of humility has always been the art of looking ashamed while you say beautiful things about yourself. If you ever see anybody doing this stuff and you ask him why and he gives you any reason but ego and recognition, you want to watch him because he'll lie to you about other things too. But I ended up with perhaps 12 people that I had harmed substantially, and I had done this sober. And one night after a meeting in 1968, I was sitting with a couple of AAs, one of whom I sponsored. I was sober 21 years, and he was sober 3 years. And I said, I have these resentments, and I don't feel very well, and I don't work as well as I should. What should I do about it? And he said, I think you ought to write out a new list of people you've harmed and go around and make amends to these people. Well, I thought that was strange advice to give to one of AA's leaders. But on the theory that if you ask for advice, maybe you ought to try it, I made out a list of people I'd harmed, and I had 12 names on there of people I had harmed sober. I went around and I made amends to these people, and 10 of the 12 received the amends as they should have. Two of them said I was no good, never would be any good, never had been any good, which didn't bother me because I didn't really believe them. But you know, that brought me to something else that I had been trying to deal with, and that was a bad relationship with my father. My father was a Lutheran minister who was an alcoholic, and a very badly behaved alcoholic, and it's a long story which I will capsulize briefly, but when I was 12 in Oak Park, my mother decided, and she was a Lutheran minister's daughter also, that she wanted a divorce or a separation, and my father, who was now a fundraiser, I guess figured that would be bad for business, so he took me coming home from school one day in Oak Park and drove almost nonstop down to South Georgia to Quitman, where I ended up in the space of several days in a completely different environment with people I didn't know and extremely bewildered. I don't recommend that as a way to grow up, but that's what happened, and I think that everything that happens to us in our lives happens for a good reason. I stayed in Georgia for 7 years and then went back to Oak Park where my mother and brother and sister were. But after I'd been sober a while, I could make, I think, a logical case that 99% of the harm and that relationship had been done by my father. I came to understand that if I am to get the promises that this program will deliver to you and me, logic is inadequate. So I began to call him up and suggest we get together. He was sober on his own, and he always said no. After I had made amends to those 12 people, I think everything is connected to everything else, and after I had straightened out those relationships, a business trip came up to Miami in October of 68, and I stopped in Quitman to see my father on the way back. I had not seen him for 27 years, and in those 27 years, Quitman had mushroomed from 4,000 to 5,000 people. I wish I hadn't changed any more than that. So not knowing how to proceed, I rang the doorbell, and he came to the door, and I made an amend to him, and then I told him who I was, and I said, I'd like to come in and talk with you. And he said, come in, and we talked for perhaps 25 minutes. In March of 1969, I went back to see him again unannounced, and we talked for perhaps another 25 minutes. 2 weeks later, after that second visit, he died, and I went to his funeral. Acutely aware that if I had not done this when I did, I perhaps would have missed the opportunity permanently. All I can say, if anybody here has anything like that in your life, do it now. Because next week the opportunity may be gone forever. A lot of unpleasant things happened in those growing up years directly connected with my father's drinking, and I could talk about them, and I could think about them. I could pray about them, but I could never get a handle on them to get rid of them. Healing that relationship healed me in ways that never would have happened otherwise. Everything is connected to everything else. Somehow or other, making those 12 amends to those people I had pushed around in Chicago sober in my leadership phase opened up the door so I could heal that relationship with my father before he died. I came into AA, as I say, with those two major handicaps. I was very grateful to learn that nobody in AA argued about whose higher power was higher. Because the way I was brought up, they said that if you don't believe this way, you're going to be part of an eternal marshmallow roast, and you might be one of the marshmallows. And when I would ask why, they would say, that's because God loves you. And I gradually decided I could live better with less cosmic affection. And by the time I came to AA, I was a fallen away atheist. I didn't believe in anything. I don't know when I became an alcoholic. I know that when I was 8 or 9, still living up north, and there was some beer or wine left in a glass and nobody was looking, I'd snap up a gulp because I liked the way it tasted. And when I was 12, down in Quitman, I used to pick the lock on my aunt's liquor closet and take a drink out of the whiskey bottle and then add some water so nobody would know it was gone. The trouble with trouble is it starts out like fun, and that's the way my drinking started out. Because alcohol glued me together in some crucial ways and enabled me to function in a world I could not understand, that I could not cope with, that I couldn't deal with, and it would glue me together enough that I could go out and live and do what I had to do and then come back and drink some more. I started college after I finished high school. I became an increasingly rotten student. I couldn't learn anything, and my energy and time and hostility went mostly into sports. My favorite sport was boxing, and I wanted to be middleweight champion of the world. And I think I would have been, except I had a severe handicap. I couldn't whip anybody. And I lasted 1.5 years at my first college, and I ended up in Chicago and started another college. I was boxing for the Madison Athletic Club on the west side of Chicago. The war had come along, and I decided to be a pilot in the Navy, and that was part of the act. I never particularly cared for airplanes, but it was the act of the lover and the athlete and the drinker and the sophisticate and the aviator. And I started off to learn to fly, and while I was a cadet, we could only get drunk on weekends. And then after I got commissioned, we could get drunk any time we wanted, and that was a vast improvement. I flew single-engine seaplanes that were catapulted off cruisers and battleships. You went from 0 to 60 miles an hour in the space of about 40 feet. It wouldn't cure a hangover, but it certainly took your mind off of it for a little while. I got one decoration in World War II. It was a linoleum rug I won on a radio quiz show one night. As many of you have heard me say in the past, I destroyed 2 aircraft in World War II. Unfortunately, they both belonged to the U.S. Navy. A friend of mine pointed out that if I'd gotten 3 more, I would have been a Japanese ace. Strange things began to happen. I sought lower companions, and then I became a lower companion. In the summer of 1945, I was 23, and I went into a Navy hospital with pneumonia, which went into DTs. And I was in there for 4 weeks. I got drunk 9 out of the last 10 nights in the hospital. We had 2 other drunks in the hospital room where I was. One was a pilot in the photo squadron. He had gotten his big toe cut open on a piece of submerged metal while swimming, and they brought him in about 2:30 in the morning with some young lady that we assumed was his wife, and the next day his wife showed up, and it was somebody else. And the rest of the time I was in the hospital, his wife and his girlfriend used to come to visit him, and they never met. And we figured that just goes to show that if you live right, the Lord will take care of you. When I was sober a while, I ran into an AA who was celebrating a couple of years of sobriety. He said, when I came on this program, I had a drinking problem and a marriage problem. AA straightened out my drinking problem, and my sponsor ran off with my wife, which straightened out my marriage problem. He said, this program will work if you let it. That was the beginning of my spiritual awakening. But I began to make a few experiments in ways to drink without having trouble. I used to get up in the morning and take my gagging exercises, and I would go down to the flight line. I can remember finding myself in a, I ended up at the Naval Air Station at Norfolk, and I found myself in a car one evening. I was in the back seat of this convertible with some young lady next to me, and there was another young lady in the right front seat, and didn't know where I was, who they were, what the town was, what was going on, and I was beginning to wonder who I was. And then somebody came out of the liquor store we were parked in front of, and this was a friend of mine, and we drove back because I'd been asking questions, trying to pretend that I knew what the answers were. And it turned out that we'd been at a party, and I'd known these ladies for several days. We were old friends, in other words. But weird things would begin to happen, and I sobered up a while, and I ran into that statement that alcoholics are sensitive people. And I think there's no question about it. It reminded me of an experience I had at Norfolk. Some friends fixed me up with a blind date, and in her honor, I got blind. And as we were driving her home, we had to stop the car so I could get out and throw up. And as I was walking her to the door, I had to go behind a bush and throw up. And then I was very hurt because she wouldn't kiss me goodnight. I didn't look for any outside help because I knew I was going to be able to handle all of these things by myself. Jerry mentioned a story of Wino Joe's last night. Joe told me one while back about the lady who went to the psychiatrist for 5 years. Finally, she said, "Doctor, tell me the truth. What's wrong with me?" He said, "Madam, you are crazy. You're nuts. You're insane." She was somewhat taken aback, and she said, "I think I want a second opinion." He said, "All right, you're ugly, too." Well, when I got to Norfolk, I was supposed to come back and see the personnel officer in a couple of days, and I got lost for 2.5 weeks. So they brought me into the office and said they thought it would be an awfully good idea if I got out of the Navy, and I thought that might be a pretty good idea, too. So I went to Great Lakes, and I got separated on December 8th of 1945. I traveled for 3 days and 3 nights and got home to Oak Park, where I was living about 50 miles away. And I knew I was going to have to do something about my drinking, but I figured I didn't want to rush into this. And I decided to go down to Cincinnati over New Year's, and I ended up in Milwaukee drunk for 3 days. And I drank myself sober on New Year's morning, and I had a kind of shocking experience. It was a bottom of sorts, because I ended up with what had to be the worst-looking woman in the Middle West. She frightened me into 6 weeks of sobriety. She looked like $1 million, and the only reason I say that is because I've never seen $1 million, and she looked like something I've never seen before. Which I guess proves that beauty is only skin deep, but ugly goes right to the bone. So I began to make experiments, and when I worked, if I took more than half an hour for lunch, they had to retrain me. And I started to drink only on weekends and only after 5 o'clock, and I quit smoking and a variety of things. I like to drink in sophisticated places. And one evening, a friend of mine and I were drinking in a sophisticated place on Wilson Avenue in Chicago called the Backstage Bar. Entertainment at the Backstage Bar was provided by young ladies who would dance on top of the bar, removing various articles of clothing while they performed, and if you were worthy, they would drink with you. And my friend and I were worthy, and they sat and drank with us, and then we ran out of money, and they left. But from that and some other experiences, I've come to the realization that if a lady who dances with no clothes on sits at your table, drinks with you, and says that she loves you, beware, she might not be sincere. One night, a group of us were having a party on the 13th floor of the old Continental Hotel on North Michigan Avenue, and we ran out of booze, and they sent me out because I was the soberest. And I got lost. The hotel has a sunken lobby, and I got lost wandering around there, so I finally went up on the mezzanine to reconnoiter. I went in the men's room and walked out on the... There was a sign that said exit. I walked through the door, and there was a fire escape, one story above the sidewalk. And I walked down this swinging ladder, and I got to the bottom, and I was still about 10 feet above the sidewalk. And I was pretty punchy, but I knew that if I jumped, it was going to be very hard on my arches. So I walked back up the ladder, and the door to the men's room had locked behind me. So I kicked and beat on the door and screamed and shouted, and finally some startled citizen let me in. But I was talking in tongues years before anybody ever heard of the Pentecostal movement. I was always losing my car. I think perhaps Of all the sights, there's nothing more heartwarming than an alcoholic who has been reunited with his automobile. When I would black out and I would become increasingly confused, a friend of mine and I were going up to Glenview to fly one day, and the field closed in with a snowstorm, and we went into Chicago to have a few drinks, and he passed out, and he'd opened the car door on his head somewhere along the day, so I had to get his head sewed back together. And I was driving him out North Avenue. He lived in St. Charles, which is 35 miles west of Chicago. The snow was falling very thickly, and I would stop the car and go into a saloon, get a bottle of beer, ask directions, and then get back in the car and start driving west. And about the time the beer had gone, my directions had fled from my memory. So I would stop at another saloon for another bottle of beer and fresh directions. I went in one of these saloons, and there was this fine-looking large dog on the floor, and I said hello, and the dog bit me on the leg. Well, I really didn't think anything of it. And I finally got home, and a couple of days later, I went to the doctor because somewhere in that trip I'd gotten my nose broken. And I accidentally mentioned that I'd been bitten by this dog, and the doctor was quite concerned. He said, "You go find that dog." So I went from bar to bar on North Avenue. I said, "You've got a dog that bit me the other night?" And he said, "No." So I ended up taking rabies shots for 2 weeks. Just to be on the safe side, I made out a list of people to bite in case they didn't work. I began to read all those books that tell you how to straighten out your life. I read one by a New York psychiatrist who said we're alcoholic because we have too much pressure on the brain. He said this makes us compulsive drinkers and gives us rotten personalities. Well, I knew I had a lot of pressure on my brain because something was shoving all the hair out of my scalp. And he said that a spinal tap would take care of this, and I wrote him and asked him if anybody around Chicago could tap my brain, and he wrote back and said no. So I bought another book. And I got Rabbi Liebman's Peace of Mind. And I was inspired by that. It was a very, very popular and effective book. Everybody thought this was marvelous, and I thought this is really going to change my life. And then I learned that Liebman had committed suicide, and I thought I didn't need that much change at the moment. And I got Dorothea Brandy's book, Wake Up and Live. And she said, act as if it's impossible to fail. And I tried that for a while until one day I tried it with the dry heaves, and it didn't work. And I read Seal and Peel and Link and Fink and you name it, I read it. And all of them had one thing in common. They told me how I was supposed to be. And I was sane and unselfish and useful and happy. Nobody ever told me how to get from where I was to that goal. I came into AA and gradually came to understand that AA describes the goal, which is a spiritual awakening as a result of these 12 steps, but it also tells me how to get there. Step by step from 1 all the way up to 12, and when I go up get to 12, I can go back to 1 and work my way up again and again and again. AA is the only place I have ever found those things that I need to live, not just soberly, but to live with some usefulness and responsibility and happiness. I made the experiments, and in August of 1947, I got a major gift. I got drunk again. I've been drunker and sicker, and I wasn't in trouble. But suddenly I was no longer able to lie about the truth of my condition. No longer did I have these smart, glib, stupid answers that this time it's going to be different, this time I'm going to make it work, this time I know how to solve the problem, or this time I'll stay sober on my own. I was sober a week when I called AA, and I tried to lie every bit of that time, and I was unable to. I was probably more honest than I've ever been before or since. And I called AA, and I went to my first meeting on a Sunday morning. A man was sober 5 years, took me. And I walked out of that meeting, and I didn't think that anything was different. And yet I haven't had a drink since. I began to experience the power and the healing and the love that's part of Alcoholics Anonymous that I only dimly understand today. A group of strangers put out their hands, and they said, "How can we help?" And it's useful for me to remember that when a new person comes and we put out that hand, that's the hand of God. But when that new person puts out that hand for help, this too is the hand of God. If gratitude is more than a word with me, then I'll be here and in the shape to pass on what you people have given me all of these years. Well, I began to go to meetings, and I had a really flattened ego, I'll tell you. But gradually, after 5 or 6 months, I began to get back some of the things I had lost, like pride and greed and arrogance and self-centeredness and all of these things. And with a year of sobriety, I almost went to jail for some very dishonest business activities. And I talked to some AAs I knew, and I said, I wonder if I've missed something in the program. And they said, son, you missed the whole program. And I said, I see. They said, you kept such an open mind that the whole program just blew right through. So I picked up the big book, and it said, write an inventory. And I wrote the most honest inventory you could find. And then I took the most honest fifth step I could ever take, because fright has always increased my zest for spiritual growth. And after that fifth step, I knew something about myself and you and God that I never knew before and never would have known without doing that work. Today I believe in God, and I believe in you, and I believe in this program, and I could not separate one from the other, because I believed in you before I believed in God. And I began to work the steps, and then I spent a number of years as a mystic, and I began to make all those experiments in using prayer to get what you want. And sometime back, I ran across a quote of Meister Eckhart's. And he said, when I pray for something, I do not pray. When I pray for nothing, I really pray. And what I have come to understand, and those years I was out of the country, I used to put in an hour and a half a day, generally, in meditation. And it was very helpful. But I think I had to do enough with meditation to understand what it would do. Then I had to do enough more to understand what it would not do. What will only be accomplished by working and reworking every one of these 12 steps. I still shoot for an hour and a half a day of meditation and get it most of the days. But I used to think that step 11 was more important than the other steps. I don't believe that anymore. I think that each step is equally important, and I have to stay with you to be reminded of what I need to do with these steps. When I work with an alcoholic, I don't try to tell him how to run his life or his family or his kids or his job or anything else. I try to help him and spend time with him and encourage him to work the 12 steps, because if he does this, he will find his own answers. He will find the freedom which we're promised in this AA program. We start with step 1, we take step 3 aloud, we talk about step 2 on the basis of honesty and sanity being synonymous. If I lie about anything, it destroys my ability to see the truth about everything. And then we take step 3 aloud using that prayer on page 63, which goes something like, God, I offer myself to you to build with me and to do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of your power, your love, and your way of life. May I do your will always. And then very soon we tell them to write an inventory, a fourth step. If you look at Bill's story on page 13 and 14 in the big book, Bill took the first 8 steps of this program within the first week he was sober. I have never seen anybody in AA get in trouble from working the 12 steps too soon. Over and over, I have seen AAs get in terrible trouble from working them too late or not at all. And we use headings in that inventory like resentments, dishonesty, sex, selfishness, self-pity, fear, the 7 cardinal sins. We don't use the Hazelden Guide. We use some obscure literature called the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 and 12. And you'd be amazed at how good it works. And then, as I say, in our group, we believe that if somebody comes to one of us to take a fifth step, we take it with him at the same time. We then take 6 and 7 aloud. We suggest that he write the list of people he's harmed, his 8th step, because we find that very often you will not get all of the people you've harmed simply from your list of resentments in the inventory. And we suggest also that he or she begin to make direct amends right away. As I say, this hair didn't fall out, it was beaten out. What I've learned slowly and the hard way. It's very much like that Marine that was in the saloon and suddenly jumped up and flattened this little old man next to him with a karate chop, and he let out a shout. He said, I'm a United States Marine, and that's karate from Japan. The little old man got back up on the seat, and suddenly the Marine whacked him again and let out a shout. He said, I'm a United States Marine, and that's karate from Japan. The little old man wandered out, and about half an hour later, the bartender looked up, and the same little man was walking back in, but the bartender was busy mixing drinks. And he didn't pay any attention. Suddenly he heard a thud and looked around, and the Marine was unconscious on the floor. As the little man walked out, he stopped in front of the bartender and he said, "When that so-and-so comes to, you tell him that was a hammer from Sears and Roebuck." And that's pretty much how I've learned everything. You know, alcoholics really are very hard of hearing. It's kind of like that man who was bragging about his high-technology hearing aid to a friend. He said, "This hearing aid was specially designed for me and made in Japan. It cost me $1,000. This hearing aid is so sensitive, I can hear a conversation on the street 3 blocks away." His friend said, "That's absolutely incredible. What kind is it?" Man said, "20 after 2. If I were in a plane flying at 30,000 feet and it caught on fire and somebody rushed up to me with a parachute, said, "Go through that escape hatch, pull the ripcord and save your life," what do you think I would do? Would I say, "Let's get in touch with our feelings"? Or would I say, "Nobody's going to tell me what to do"? Or would I go through the hatch without a chute hollering, "This is an individual program"? Well, you know what I'd do? I would follow the directions, and that's precisely what I try to do with the AA program. Everything I need is here, and I learned it from you, and without your help, I'd forget it. But I've seen this do over and over and over, this kind of work for alcoholics. I know a man, for example, who was around AA 15 years with many, many meetings, never stayed sober. In January of 1972, he sobered up once again. This time, he ran into some AAs who spent time with him showing him what to do. Working with others is work. It means taking step 3 aloud with them. It means sitting and helping them write inventories. It means sitting and helping them list the people they've harmed. It does not mean sitting and listening to their troubles. Because my problems are created by conditions within me which will be changed and removed through working the 12 steps. Well, this man began to work the steps in early 1972, and he's been sober ever since. Inventories, direct amends, 15 years drunk, 10 years working the steps, and he hasn't had a drink since. I know another man who was around for 12 years, again, many meetings, never stayed sober. November of 1971, he got drunk again, and he called the answering service, and somebody from our group went over to see him, spent enough time with him to show him how to do an inventory. They took step 3 aloud, and he said, "Write the inventory, and tomorrow I'll come back and we'll swap a 5th step." The next day, this man from our group went back, they swapped a 5th step. He listed the people he had harmed and began making amends by making a direct amend to his wife who was in the kitchen. He started going to our step group, drunk 12 years around AA, sober since November 71 when he began to work the 12 steps. This happens over and over and over. I know an AA who was sober 4.5 years in Chicago. He got drunk in March of 73, could not get sober. He was hospitalized 5 times in 6 months. 4 times in expensive treatment programs where he got everything that he needed except the 12 steps. He ended up in a state hospital when his insurance ran out. Somebody from our group went to see him, helped him write an inventory, started swapping 5th steps. Now, this was a man who was not about to stay sober. As soon as he got sober and got out of a hospital, he was drunk again. He began to take not one, but many 5th steps, because one of the things I have come to believe is that by opening up with more and more and more people, I become free in a way that I never could otherwise. I always had this act that I carried around. If you don't know who you are, you've got to make up somebody. And my identity always existed in your eyes. I didn't know who I was, and I didn't know who you were, but I knew that I had to be better than you to be your equal. And what I have discovered by taking many 5th steps, swapping them with many, many people, is that you and I are all even. I don't have to be any better than I am. That's good enough. And I can continue to do this if I continue to work the steps. And what we have discovered is that for people who are having problems with depression, in particular anxiety, or who cannot stay sober, if they will do a continuing strong job of reworking the steps, particularly written inventories, many 5th steps, certainly great care with direct amends, and taking step 3 aloud and 6 and 7 aloud with other people, Alcoholics, some who have had long periods of sobriety, who could not get sober again, begin to stay sober. The answers are all here in the 12 steps. I know a woman who was around a 2.5 years drunk, finally wrote an inventory, took a fifth step, began to make amends, took another fifth steps. With 6 months of sobriety, she went into a paralyzing depression. Always before, when this happened, she got drunk. That after one afternoon in that depression, an AA lady went over, and this woman took a fifth step with her in the afternoon. By that night, her depression was completely gone. She's sober 14 years. This does work. I get everything I need in Alcoholics Anonymous. All I have to do is follow the directions. When I meditate today, I simply try to turn my will and life over to God, and I find that the quantity influences the quality. The harder I work at this, the better my contact with God seems to be. I believe we live in two worlds. We're a bridge between the world that we see today, which generally I think is real and I suspect is not, and the world of the Spirit that I talk about and really believe in, generally only when my life goes very badly. But to the degree that I work and rework all of these steps and spend enough time in prayer and meditation, not instructing God what to do, but simply finding out what I'm supposed to be, I get all of those things that I need, and they turn out to be what I really want. I think any alcoholic who will do this kind of continuing work with the 12 steps has a message. And the message I have perceived is perhaps summed up by a man I know who was around AA for years, never stayed sober, a very badly behaved drunk, and in January of 1971 he came back once again. This time with a difference, he began to work the 12 steps. He began to go to our group, and he had three boys, the youngest of whom was 8, and the 8-year-old was in a class for retarded children because he could not learn. And as the father began to work the steps in 1971 and stay sober and change, this boy gradually went from a class for retarded children to a regular class doing average work. And as the father continued to stay sober and continued to change through the 12 steps, the boy got smarter and smarter. And he graduated from high school a year or two ago, and I had lunch with his father, and I said, "How's your youngest son doing?" His father said he was a varsity football player. He made the honor roll every grade period but one in high school. He said he wasn't retarded, I was retarded. And the father said none of these things would have happened if all I had done was quit drinking and not work the 12 steps. This is the message that I have learned from you, and I'm grateful to every one of you, because without your help and without my continuing partnership with you and AA, I would soon forget them. You've changed my life. Years ago, you put out your hand and said, "How can we help?" And you've helped me every day of my life since then. Thank you very much.